So gauge anomalies are in some ways very similar to chiral anomalies that we spent the last two lectures studying. In particular, we can derive them using almost the same arguments that we went through yesterday. So we can derive them either from a functional integral perspective or by computing Feynman diagrams. We won't go through those derivations in complete detail, just make a few comments on the differences between how those computations would go in computing gauge anomalies and chiral anomalies. So in some ways, they're very similar, but their physical implications are drastically different. So chiral anomalies can explain experiments. They're just the failure of some global symmetries. The symmetries in the quantum theory are different than we thought they were in the classical theory. Gauge anomalies, on the other hand, are a terrible thing. They, in general, destroy the consistency of our theory, and we want to avoid them at all costs. So what we're going to see is that we demand that our non-abelian gauge theories are anomaly-free. That will put constraints on the allowed types of matter that we're allowed. In particular, the types of chiral fermions we're allowed to couple to non-abelian gauge theory.
Wait, Dan, did you say abelian gauge theories can have anomalies?
So what I said is just now, or are you referring to something that yesterday? No. If we want our theory to have a gauge symmetry, it can't have an anomaly.
What did you say non-abelian?
Well, so it's the story is worse if we have an anomaly in a non-abelian gauge theory, because for non-abelian gauge theories, the gauge symmetry is required for renormalizability of the theory. For non-abelian gauge theories, it's not good to break the gauge symmetry, but it's possible to renormalize a non-abelian gauge theory if we got, for instance, a mass term. It's not quite as bad.
For abelian gauge.
Abelian, yes. It's still bad, but not as bad. Okay. So the theory we're going to study will be a non-abelian gauge theory coupled to a chiral fermion, and let's just assume it's a left-handed fermion that lives in some representation, which we'll leave unspecified for now, of that non-abelian gauge group. So if we just write out theory, it will look this. And so here, psi L is a chiral fermion. Let's just apply the projection operator to the Dirac fermion. And we're for now leaving unspecified what representation it lives in. So this is a non-abelian gauge theory, and it's gauge invariant. So in particular, if we make a transformation, psi L goes to e to the I beta I ti psi L, which we can call u psi L, and simultaneously take the gauge field to u a u inverse plus u inverse u. That's a symmetry. So it's a gauge symmetry, it's a local symmetry. Every local symmetry has a global subgroup. So we can apply Noether's theorem to this symmetry and find a conserved current. And the associated conserved current in this case, so I'll just call it JL, and it looks very similar to the currents we're considering in the last two lectures, except we just have the generators sandwiched in between our fermion fields. And so this follows just from applying Noether's theorem to the global subgroup, where we take our gauge transformation parameters, beta, to be constants. This current, despite how similar it looks to the currents we considered yesterday, has a very different interpretation than the currents we considered yesterday. And that's going to be partially responsible for why gauge anomalies have such a different physical interpretation from the chiral anomalies we've considered so far. So in particular, if we look at this current, this is not gauge invariant. If we tried to apply this transformation to this current, we would not end up with what we started. So this is not gauge invariant and therefore not directly observable. So we'll need a different interpretation of this current. And well, the simplest way to figure out how to interpret this current is to look at the equations of motion, classical equations of motion that follow from applying the Euler-Lagrange equations to this Lagrangian for the gauge field. So let's do that. So the equations of motion for A mu A just follow Euler Lagrange equations. So d nu derivative of the Lagrangian with respect d nu A mu is equal to dl A mu. And if we compute both sides, on the left, we get A1 over G squared D nu F mu nu, the eighth component. And over on the right-hand side, so the first term came from looking at that. The second, the right-hand side just comes from taking the derivative here. And we see that the coefficient of A is basically just the current. It's psi gamma t psi. So those are our equations of motion for A. And to relate, so we see that the equations of motion involve this current we want to interpret. And if we apply d mu to the equations of motion, well, on the left-hand side, we'll then have d mu d nu, which is symmetric under the exchange of mu nu times f mu nu, which is anti-symmetric. So on the left-hand side, we get zero. And over on the right-hand side, we've got covariant derivative of AL nu. 0. So this current is covariantly conserved instead of just conserved within ordinary derivative. And furthermore, we see that the conservation of this current is connected to the equations of motion for the gauge field. So if this equation is wrong, which it is, at least under some circumstances, then the equations of motion for the gauge field are wrong. So I won't derive this in detail, although I'll motivate some features of the correct equation, but let me just write it down now so we can discuss some aspects of it. So the correct equation, so this is wrong. Correct equation is the covariant derivative of J L. These are wrong over here. Is 1 over 24 pi squared times an epsilon derivative of a trace of following combination of the generators and gauge fields, TA a nu e rho sigma minus I over 4 a nu a rho a sigma. Which can also be written in terms of components. It'd be a useful way to write it. As do the trace A B D rho A sigma C minus I over 4 nu B A rho sigma C all contracted with this object D ABC, where D ABC is the symmetrized trace over the generators. So here this is completely symmetric under permutation of any of the indices I've written explicitly. Symmetrized over the last two indices and together with the cyclicity of the trace, that implies that it's completely symmetric. And you know, we'll motivate some features of this formula in a minute. We're not going to derive it completely. But this is the correct equation. And so the key point here is that unlike the chiral anomaly, the existence of a gauge anomaly implies that the equations of motion are wrong. And so that basically means we started from the wrong Lagrangian. We should have included extra terms to get the right equations of motion. But if we include the extra terms that we'd need to get the right-hand side over here, we've been including non-gauge invariant terms. So if there's an anomaly, our theory is not gauge invariant. Doing gauge transformation will change our Lagrangian. And as we saw, or at least a sketch of in QFT2, for non-abelian gauge theories, the gauge symmetry reduces the severity of the UV divergences and is essential in showing that the theory is renormalizable and unitary. So if the right-hand side of this equation is non-zero, if there is an anomaly, then the theory is not consistent. So we would need extra terms in L, which means it's not gauge invariant. Therefore, not renormalizable. So we need the anomaly to vanish in order to have a consistent theory. And in general, if we're doing a functional integral, we'd be integrating over all possible gauge field configurations. So there's no reason for for a general gauge field configuration, this combination of the gauge fields is not going to vanish. And so if we want this to vanish, what we really need to vanish are these coefficients, D, A, B, C. These are just constants. And if these constants are zero or add up to zero, if we've got multiple fermions, then the anomaly will cancel for any possible gauge field configuration. So that's, that's what we'll consider in the later in the lecture, so we'll see what the vanishing of the anomaly implies for the allowed chiral fermion content of the theory. So we'll discuss that in some detail later on. But before we do that, I just want to make a few comments about the differences in the two derivations we saw yesterday for the chiral anomaly and for the gauge anomaly. So both of those derivations, the functional integral derivation and the Feynman diagram derivation, can be used to derive this formula with some slight modifications. And I just want to discuss those modifications, and we can learn a few things about some properties of this formula thinking about how those derivations would go. I won't go through all the details. So we are going to derive this using functional integrals. So what would change? So one thing that would clearly change is we'd have extra factors, or we didn't have any factors before, of the generators. It's not quite as easy to see that we get this combination of the generators from the functional integral perspective. I'll make some comments about how we can guess that we might get this combination of generators when I discuss the Feynman diagram derivation. Let's just think about how this derivation would go if we start with this theory with only a single left-handed fermion. So For this discussion, I'll work in Euclidean space. I should have mentioned earlier, but this formula is valid in Minkowski space. The eyes will be different or in Euclidean space. But as we saw yesterday in the functional integral derivation, working in Euclidean space made things much easier because then we had Hermitian operators and we could expand in a complete set of eigenfunctions rather easily. So let's think about how this derivation would change. We're considering the gauge anomaly instead of the chiral anomaly. So the object we computed yesterday was a functional integral that was an integral only over the fermion fields. So if in this theory we only have a left-handed fermion field, and what we would want to integrate over is, well, the gauge kinetic term's not so interesting, so let's just write down the, because it's independent of the fermions, so we can just look at the fermion kinetic term. I can write like this. And, well, this looks like a Gaussian integral, which we all know how to do. And you expect that the result here should just be proportional to the determinant of the operator that's sitting here. So it should be proportional to the determinant of id slash. But if we apply id slash to psi l, so id slash psi l is equal to id slash pl psi. And so only since this is a projection operator, we could put a p, or we could write this as id slash pl plus PR. That's the same. This is the same as ID slash. And the PR part is zero because PR times PL is zero. So really, it's the determinant of ID slash PL. We get. So that's what we'd expect. But let's think a little bit more carefully and see if this actually makes sense. So this operator, id slash pl, well, we can also write that as ipr d slash. So this maps psi l to psi r. So it maps left-handed fermions to right-handed fermions. And, well, right-handed fermions are not in the part of the Hilbert space that we're considering here. So it's not clear if this makes sense, that this operator maps psi l to something that's not in our Hilbert space. So it's not clear if this exists or is well defined. So we can consider a related operator that will map left-handed fermions to left-handed fermions, so we can avoid this problem. And, well, we can do that just by basically squaring this operator. And we consider I d slash pl dagger I d slash pl. This maps psi l to psi l. So there's no such problem. And if we put this type of operator in a functional integral like that, there would be no ambiguities or questions about whether or not. The determinant of this operator exists. So this thing exists and has a well-defined engage invariant determinant. So we can use that to try to make sense of this expression. So the determinant of I d/PL dagger id/PL. Well, assuming the right-hand side exists, we can write this as determinant of I d/PL squared, modulus squared. And so this exists, and if the right-hand side exists, should look like this. So we can use this equation to define the modulus of this path integral. But it doesn't give us any information about the phase. And, well, it's precisely when the phase cannot be defined in a gauge invariant manner that there is an anomaly. Or equivalently, if the imaginary part of the effective action gauge field So this is another way to think about the anomaly. It's an ambiguity in the phase of our functional integrals or the imaginary part of our effective action in Euclidean signature. Okay. And yeah, so apart from this, a related fact is, so besides having to include additional factors of TA, the fact that this operator, id/PL, it maps different parts of our Hilbert space to each other, it's also not Hermitian. So the other modification to yesterday's derivation we'd have to make is we would want to expand our fermion field in terms of eigenfunctions of some Hermitian operator that maps the same parts of the Hilbert space to the same parts of the Hilbert space, so something like this. That's the but with that modification and this modification, otherwise the derivation goes pretty much the same way as yesterday. Any questions on? Yes. Sorry.
So why is it that we weren't sure that the determinant of that operator exists?
So, well, it's not clear whether this expression makes sense. But we're integrating only over the left-handed field and its conjugate. But what we're trying to integrate, well, here's a left-handed conjugate field, but this is right-handed. So how do we integrate over that? It's not It may or may not make sense. It's sometimes possible to make sense if the theory is anomaly free, but if it has anomalies, then there's no unambiguous way how to.
Why does that not make sense? Doesn't the right-handed part just like get killed off when you take a product with the left-handed spin?
Well, so for instance, if we were looking at a mass term, we'd have something like that would be a mixing term. If there's no gammas in between, then it'd be psi bar L psi bar, that's non-zero. If we had a gamma, then
yeah.
So it shouldn't be zero. We're trying to integrate over it, but it's not really part of our Hilbert space. So. And like, well, if we just look at this expression, in order to compute the determinant in terms of the eigenfunctions, well, this maps one part of the Hilbert space to another, so it doesn't have, in terms of the eigenvalues, it doesn't have well-defined eigenvalues.
Just why is that right-handed again?
It's because of this. So, well, we can write I d slash psi L as I d slash p L psi. We can write as p r I d slash psi. So, this is some spinner, and we're applying a right-handed projection operator to it. So, again, I'm not going to go through the whole derivation, but I just want to make a few comments about how the Feynman diagram derivation would go. So, we've seen already that our gauge field couples directly to our current JL. We computed the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the field. We got just the current. So the diagrams we'd want to consider would be similar to yesterday. Here. For gauge anomalies, there's no conflict between two different symmetries, just the symmetry itself is inconsistent. So what we'd want to compute would be the three-point correlation function of the currents, JL. And so we could do that by considering these two diagrams and throwing away the gauge fields and the couplings. And if these are the diagrams we want to consider, we can immediately, or in one line, read off the how the anomaly depends on the generators. And as I mentioned, that's the key part of the formula I wrote on the top board. So let's do that. So if we were going to compute this diagram, and we don't care about anything else besides how it depends on the generators, this diagram, so we've got a fermion loop, so it'll be a trace over the generators. And we start here. We'd first have a TA at this vertex going against the lines. Then we'd have a TC and then a TB. And for the other diagram, it would be the same, except we would go in the opposite order. So again, starting here, we'd have a TA, then a TB, then a TC. And that's proportional to so that's symmetric under the exchange of B and C. So it's proportional to the symmetrized trace. We can also write it in terms of an anti-commutator. So this is the key part of the anomaly formula, and it follows just by knowing which diagrams we need to look at in this derivation. And so otherwise, the derivation will go through very much like what you did in tutorial. But these diagrams, also if these diagrams don't add up to zero, then there's a new contribution to the there's a correction to the three-point vertex of the theory. There's not going to be any corresponding correction to the four-point vertex. So these diagrams will spoil the relationship between the three and four-point vertex, which had to have a very precise relationship in order for gauge invariance to be preserved. So another way we can see that the anomaly ruins gauge invariance is just that these diagrams ruin the relationship. Between this and this at one loop. So loss of gauge invariance. Yet another way we can see that is that these diagrams are not zero. Also draw a diagram like this, it will give a mass. For a mu, and again, loss of gauge invariance. So these are all related, but there's a bunch of different ways you can look at it. And one other comment is that if we're computing, so in yesterday's tutorial, when you computed the corresponding diagrams for the chiral anomaly, what we were interested in was the term that was proportional to gamma 5. And tracing over gamma 5 and for other gamma matrices gives the epsilon. The result and the form of the diagrams suggests that the same thing is true here, and in fact it is. So what's going to contribute to the anomaly will be the gamma 5 term. And the only difference between psi L and psi R, or left and right-handed fermion, they have different projection operators in front of them, PL or PR. And the difference between PL and PR is the sign in front of gamma 5. So that suggests, and in fact, you can show that left and right-handed fermions contribute to the anomaly with opposite signs. That's all I wanted to say about the Feynman diagram derivation. Slightly more involved than what you did yesterday, but works more or less the same way. Any questions on this? Yes.
Does that mean if you have both psi left and psi right, the like anomaly cancels?
That's exactly right, yes. And that's where we're going next. So the next thing I want to talk about is under what conditions the anomaly cancels or is just zero. So we know we need the anomaly to be zero in order to have a consistent theory that's actually gauge invariant. And sometimes we actually have to go through and compute all of these traces. But many times there are simple cancellations, like the one Jessica just pointed out. Or we can argue on general principles that these traces are zero for certain types of chiral fermions or certain types of gauge groups. So that's what we'll discuss next is actually there's a pretty large class of cases where we don't actually have to do any computations to know that the anomaly is zero. But there's a important subset of cases where we do have to do some computations and see that our choice of chiral matter is consistent. So we need the anomaly to cancel. And I'll define this object A, ABC, which is closely related to what I called DABC before. So we need this to be zero. And so I'll define AABC to be sum over all fermions, I'll write it in a couple of different ways, of the trace of TA, anticommutator of TB and TC, or noting that left and right-handed fermions contribute with opposite signs. Perhaps the most useful way to write this is the sum over left-handed fermions of the trace of TA for the left-handed fermions, the anticommutator of TB and TC, minus the same sum over the right-handed fermions. So this is what we need to finish. So number of cases where we don't actually have to compute anything. And let's consider those first. Cases with trivial cancellation. or no contributions. So the first is the one Jessica pointed out. So if psi L and psi R live in the same rep, then they cancel. So that's because of this minus sign here. And so our discussion has been entirely in terms of chiral fermions. We can always think of a Dirac fermion as composed of a left and a right-handed part. So if we have a Dirac fermion, we can think of that as a left and a right-handed fermion that live in the same rep. So Dirac is in this case, the Dirac psi is psi L plus psi R in the same rep. Okay. The other case where there's a trivial cancellation is if we have a left-handed fermion and a right-handed fermion that live in equivalent reps. So by an equivalent rep, I mean one where TL is U TR U inverse, or U unitary. And so if we plug this in here, by the cyclicity of the trace, all of the U's and U inverses will cancel. The one at front, we can cycle to the back. So it's the same sort of cancellation if they live in equivalent reps.
Why does it have to be unitary?
In general, that's probably too strong of a condition, but that's cases of interest. It's usually unitary, but I think that's stronger than actually the definition of equivalent rep. So sorry about that. Okay, so those are the two cases where we've got a trivial cancellation. There are also a number of cases where particular types of fermions just don't contribute. And one of the biggest is that fermions in real or pseudo-real reps don't contribute. And a rep is pseudo-real if the transpose of the generators is equal to minus V times the generators times V inverse for the unitary. And it's real if these identity. And so to see this, to see that any rep like this will have a vanishing symmetrized trace. We can just compute it. So we compute this symmetrized trace. Well, the trace of a matrix is equal to the trace of the transpose. So we can transpose this, and we get T, BL, TC, L, anti-commutator, TA, transpose. We can use the cyclicity of the trace to bring the TA transpose to the front. And this is an anti-commutator, so we can write the matrices in any order we like. And then using this property, if we assume that it's a pseudo-real representation, all the V's will cancel again by the cyclicity of the trace. We just get 3 minus signs times what we started with. So the trace is equal to minus itself, so it's 0. And so there's actually a fairly long list of groups that only have real or pseudo-real representations. Those include SU2, SO2N plus 1, N greater than 1, SO4N, N greater than 2, SP2N, or N greater than or equal to 3, and most of the exceptional groups. And any direct products that only involve these groups. These all have only pseudo-real reps. So that's a substantial fraction of the simple compact Lie groups that we don't have to worry about anomalies for. There's another class that I'm not going to show. It's slightly more involved, but SO4N plus 2 for N greater than 1 and E6 do have reps that are not pseudo-real. But none contribute to the anomaly. So that only leaves a few simple compact Lie groups that we've left off the list. And I'll come back to those in a minute. But there's one other important class of, or one other important case where the fermions don't contribute to the anomaly. And that's the case where we have massive fermions. So if we've got a direct mass, then we have a direct fermion, which we already know doesn't contribute. So the only interesting case left is we can ask the question, do massive Majorana fermions contribute? So if we have a Majorana mass term, that will look something like this. And let's suppose that there's psi L lives in some representation of our gauge group. Psi L will transform like this. Psi L transpose will transform like this with a transpose in the exponential. And so and the mass term will transform like M psi L transpose sigma 2 e to the I beta A TA plus TA transpose psi L. And so this is going to be invariant only if TA is equal to minus TA transpose, which is a case we already considered. That's the case where we have a real representation. And this also works for the more general case where we have a mass matrix that mixes several different Majorana fermions. Yeah. So we have reduced the number of cases where we actually need to do any computations by a significant amount. So what's left? Only case that's left we only need to compute for massless fermions if the gauge group is SU(n) or n greater than or equal to 3 or U1 or products involving these. So we've reduced it, the amount of work we need to do by a lot, but well, these gauge groups are some of the most common ones you encounter. So in practice, it is a concern. And one case of great interest is the standard model, which has gauge group SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. So there are many possible anomalies here. And in tutorial next week, we'll look at how these anomalies cancel. It's a consistent theory. So any questions on this? Okay, so and summarize in 4 words and 2 pictures. So chiral anomalies are good, used to explain experiments. Gauge anomalies are bad, ruin the consistency of our theory. But we can use similar techniques to compute both. And we've seen that anomalies are connected to, well, they're observable in the IR, they have IR consequences, they're connected to the UV divergences of the theory. We can't find a regulator that respects our symmetries. So that's all I wanted to say on anomalies, and next Monday and Tuesday, you'll have gong, and then I'll resume on Wednesday with a, what will seem like at first, a very distinct topic. We'll talk about instantons. We'll see there's some connections at the end of next week. I'll see you next Wednesday.